Good evening, everybody. We appreciate John doing the class last week. We had the great privilege of being with Leah's Freeze family up at Bonna that day, and to remember a great man. And we appreciated John doing the class the other night. Thank you very much, John, and study of Titus. I've been telling our elders for the last 2 years that I was hoping to do a class series on Ecclesiastes. We had a few things happen in those 2 years that you might remember, but I have been trying to think my way through this book, and I'm not claiming that I have it figured out yet, and I'm sure we won't have when we get to the end of our reading through it this quarter in this class. I do, however, think that I can see reflected in this book a human struggle, and it's a struggle that goes on in the life of somebody who has maybe started out with the assumption that if he'll just live for the Lord, things will go smoothly for him, things will go well for him, and he'll be satisfied, and he'll be in sort of in control of his situations in life. And he's lived long enough to figure out that that's not really how things work. And and he's lived long enough then to try to experiment with other things and to find out if he can find the things that truly fulfill and give meaning in his life in other places, all these other places. None of them have worked either. And the problem is he's done that long enough now that he's old enough to realize my life is going to be over one of these days, before I've even figured out what to do with it. And he starts to panic, and it starts to frighten him, and it shakes him when he thinks of his own mortality and whether his life, all the things he's tried to learn, all the things he's tried to do, all the places he's tried to go, all the things he's tried to collect, everything he's tried to experience, won't even be remembered. What then? And that's the nature of this book. It's hard to outline. It jumps around. There are times when the speaker seems to contradict himself. There are parts of it that seem so downhearted that you get stuck with that. And the thing is, it has one of the most encouraging messages of any book in the Bible. And that's what we want to try to pursue. I noticed something a while back from the writings of Peter Kraft. Peter Kraft is a Boston College professor. He's done a lot of writing about apologetics from a philosophical standpoint, which is what we would call Christian evidences. He's a brilliant man. This statement from his caught my attention, and I'd like you to consider it for a moment. He says, Ecclesiastes is the one book in the Bible that modern man most needs to read, for it is lesson one, and the rest of the Bible is lesson two, and modernity does not need lesson two because it does not heed lesson one. Now think about that. If somebody doesn't pay attention to the message of Ecclesiastes, he doesn't see the need for the rest of the Bible. He says, whenever I teach the Bible as a whole, I always begin with Ecclesiastes. In another age, we could begin with God's beginning, Genesis. But in this age, the age of man, we must begin where the patient is. We must begin with Ecclesiastes. Would you ever have thought of starting a study of Scripture with Ecclesiastes? I've sort of saved it to last in a lot of ways. I used to be fascinated with this book when I was young because I thought it put smugness and hypocrisy and all those kind of things in its place. I've come to believe instead that this is a book that's much more meant for people who are my age now, and it's lessons learned from experience. Why would anyone think that these days we need to start with Ecclesiastes? Have you ever run across anybody who, no matter how hard you could try to prove Genesis, it didn't make any difference to them? Of course you have. That's most people in American culture right now. Most people who've been infected or affected by postmodernism, to shrug off, to laugh everything off, to take the David Letterman approach to life itself, make a joke of it, to think that no one can know anything that's real, nothing really matters in the long run, a cynical joke of everything, would just shrug it off unless he pays attention to the message of this book. I have found out, I made a list of these and working on this in recent weeks here. The things that I could find that were said about Ecclesiastes, one writer says, is the most unusual book in the Bible. There's not another one like it. No other literature in the Bible is like this one. Another guy says Ecclesiastes is the most personal book in the Bible. It's about one man's effort to make sense of his life in these very, very tender times in his journey. And it's filled with pronouns, personal pronouns, I, me, and my. You notice those as we go along. Another one says that Ecclesiastes is the most modern book in the Bible. It's someone who is occupied with the meaning of his own life and struggling with it, and he makes all the mistakes that we make in our lives. Another writer says Ecclesiastes is the most dangerous book in the Bible. That one got my attention. So now then I'm being told that if I want to speak to modern man, I have to start with Ecclesiastes, and then I'm being told that this is the most dangerous book in the Bible. And I got to wonder, why would anybody say that? And I've checked on some of the statements made in this book. And just think of these statements. If you didn't know the background of this at all, if you didn't consider any other of the context of the book, what would you make of these statements? I'm reading these from Brother Loveland's New Revised Standard Version tonight, and I want you to think about it with me. This is chapter 2, verse 16. For there's no enduring remembrance of the wise or of fools, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. The wise die just as the fools. So I hated life. Now, if you didn't know anything else, what would you think of that statement? What view of life? Would you keep trying? Would you keep thinking it was worth it? Would you keep making the effort? Or look over here at another passage with me right quick. Chapter 7, verse 15. In my vain life, I have seen everything. There are righteous people who perish in their righteousness, and there are wicked people who prolong their life in their evil doing. What would you think? What would you make of that if you didn't know the rest of the story? Would you think it makes any difference how you live your life? Not only that you live, but how you live. So look over at chapter 9. At verse 11, again I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to the skillful, but time and chance happen to them all. Would you develop the what difference does it make approach to life? Now, how much do you notice in our culture people saying, it doesn't matter, it makes no difference, it won't be remembered anyhow? That's very much the spirit of things. And that's what this fellow has identified. And if you didn't know the rest of his observation or what his point is in making these statements, it would be dangerous in the extreme. So let's take a look for a moment at Ecclesiastes' look at life. The perspective that it takes here, and I'm going to start at verse 4 of chapter 1, and we'll come back to the other part in a minute. But I'd like you to have the particular viewpoint in mind that he's trying to get us to think about. Verse 4, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun, so we mentioned a generation, tick them off now, a generation, then the sun rises and the sun goes down and it hurries to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north, round and round goes the wind, and it's on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there will they continue to flow. All things are wearisome, more than one can express. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, or the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already been in the ages before us. The people of long ago are not remembered, nor will there be any remembrance of people yet to come by those who come after them. Now summarize in your words the view of history that is recognized in that statement, the view of human experience, the view of what goes on in the world. What's he saying? All right, David said, life goes on. There is this circular pattern that goes on in the sun, the sun's movement, the water and its movement. And he says it's in life too. It's in human experience too, which means that we come and go, we make no difference, and nobody remembers, and therefore, can you spot any meaning in all of this? Now, if you just look at that and try to make sense of the mystery of it and try to wrap your mind around and try to apply it to yourself, that's the question. What is he saying? This isn't a command. Is he trying to say this is the truth revealed to me? Is he trying to say this is what God says to us about what life is about? Or what's he trying to say? And so verse 12 now, look at what he draws from this. I, the teacher, when king over Israel and Jerusalem, applied my mind to seek and to search out by wisdom all that's done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to human beings to be busy with. I saw that all the deeds that are done under the sun, I saw all the deeds that are done under the sun, and see, all is vanity and a chasing after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. What's he saying there? All of human experience is circular. It just is a cycle of life that goes on, and nothing interrupts it. And to try to find a way to make straight what is crooked and fix what is mixed up in this just turns out to be an unhappy business, an unhappy and unfulfilling exercise in fruitlessness. Now, honestly, on your down days, does it ever seem that way to you? Have you ever thought that? If you haven't, you probably haven't been thinking. I think most of us have. And that is the situation that lies in the background of this book. He starts with that observation about how things work, and then he tries to put himself in the picture, and all he can conclude is, this is all an unfortunate mess that is like chasing after wind, and it can't be fixed. Does that sound hopeless to you so far? A lot of people look at Ecclesiastes and just leave it with that and don't pursue it any further. And I think the point gets missed in that way. So look at the framework for this book now. Now I want to just to try to remind us of one simple fact with this. Chapter 1, verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the teacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. If that's the first part of this, chapter 1, verse 2. And if we spoke Hebrew, you'd be able to see a sort of melodious rhyming in those phrases, and it would be memorable in that way. Vanity of vanities doesn't quite get it the way it sounds there. So that's his starting point now. And then if you go over to chapter 12, verse 8, notice that it says, vanity of vanities, says the teacher, all is vanity. Does that sound familiar? It's exactly the same words. And in literary terms, that's called an inclusio, meaning that these two things like bracket everything that's in between. These two things are the bookends which make the perspective that is started with, also the perspective that is ended with at this point, and everything that's in between is illustrative of that outlook right there. But notice now that when he's done all of that, he traces all of his journey, notice he goes beyond that and makes a point, tells us what he believes the preceding information proves. And this is to us the most famous statement in the book, chapter 12, verses 13 and 14. This is the point of Ecclesiastes. We're not left wondering about it. The writer says, chapter 12, verse 13, the end of the matter. All has been heard. For God, fear God and keep His commandments, for that's the whole duty of everyone. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. So, the stuff in between 1, 2, and 12, 8 is not the writer's belief system. It's what he has observed about human experience, about life. And then chapter 12, verses 13 and 14 gets out of that picture and states straight out the conclusion that he believes should be drawn from all the preceding information about human experience. That's how we will approach that. We're going to read his observations, but we're going to remember where he's coming from and what he believes. What he believes is chapter 12, verses 13 and 14. And what he will tell us is how he has come to have that conviction fixed in his mind, given all that goes on in the world around him. How important would it be for us to fear God and keep his commandments, or to make people interested in that? That, David? All right, it would be without God, and that's very much what this writer will try to illustrate for us. So let's look a little bit at some of the phrases that are going to be important in our reading as we go along. We should start by noticing that what he says in verses 13 and 14 of chapter 12 is the voice of experience. This is a, there's an old Jewish, I read an old Jewish story, I think Harold Kushner is the author, the one who tells this story. A little book he wrote a few years back, When All You've Ever Wanted Isn't Enough, based on Ecclesiastes. And he tells a story of these two fellows who are lost in the thickets of the tangles of a terrible dark forest, and it has the little trails going in various directions where animals have squeezed under the briars and the brambles and the brush and the thickets and so forth. And these two fellows are frantically trying to find their way out. They're lost in the middle of all of this. And they go down a trail and it dead ends, and they're just all they've done have gotten more lost, and they head back up and take another trail, and the same thing happens again, and it's frustrating, exhausting, hopeless work, and finally they bump into each other. One of them says to the other, "Can you tell me how to get out of here?" The fellow says, "No, I'm lost too." "Well, how are we going to get out of here?" "I don't know, but I can at least show you which trails don't go where we want to go, and maybe we can help each other that way." And Kushner suggested that's what Ecclesiastes does. It tells us the trails that don't work, that people have been down before, that people have been trying for ages and have always found to be unsatisfying dead ends, so that we need not make the same mistake. So the writer of this book, you'll notice in some of the footnotes in your English translations, is Koheleth. Koheleth. The word means a gatherer. Gatherer or collector or I noticed the ESV has a footnote that says convener. So the question is, what does he gather? And so when the Hebrew word got translated into Greek, it was Ecclesiastes. That's the writer's name. It's not the name of the book. It's the speaker, in other words. So Ecclesiastes is the gatherer or the collector. What is he collecting? If it's people, and if he's gathering an assembly, then it gets translated in English as the preacher. If, however, he is the collector and the gatherer of observations and insights and wisdom, then he is the teacher. And you'll find him that it translated that way in some of the English translations. This one I read, for example. Koheleth is Hebrew, Ecclesiastes is Greek, teacher or preacher is English of this word here. Either way, it's the voice of experience. It's, the next word that's important for us is tells us that this is the It tells us what the verdict of his gathering or his examination is. Havel. Havel is the word. Probably in Hebrew, Havel would be the better way to say it. Very important is this word here. How should it be translated? What are the different ways that you notice it translated? Vanities in this version I've read. Do you have other ways that it's said in your translations? Meaningless, NIV is meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless. That's a lot of meaninglesses, isn't it? Anything else? Okay, Ginger? It uses several words, absurdity, frustration, futility, and nonsense. Sounds like a plan for life, doesn't it? Tim? I was. Go ahead and tell us. No, go ahead and tell us how. So he made the observation, good observation, that the word that we're looking at here means breath or vapor or mist. It's something that one guy said that this word means what is left when a soap bubble bursts. That's what you have here. And Tim is pointing out this is a person's name. Who is that person? Abel. Genesis 4. Now what can you tell me about Abel? All right, he was Cain's brother, which was a bad plan in itself. What happened with Abel? All right, he didn't live that long, did he? His life is brief. That mean that his, this deserves some thought. Does that mean that Abel's life was meaningless? I think we ought to think about this when we're thinking of the translation of this word in Ecclesiastes. Abel was killed by his brother, but Abel being dead still speaks, Hebrews 11 says. He offered by faith and God showed that it was pleasing. God accepted it. Abel's life was not meaningless. It was brief and temporary. And I wonder if that's not getting us closer to the meaning of this word. At least that should be considered. We shouldn't immediately think that the writer of Ecclesiastes is telling us that all of human experience is futile, empty, meaningless, useless, and pointless. There are things about human experience that look that way based on what happens that is unpredictable and unfair and the stuff that turns out to look just totally random that happens to the good as well as the evil, all that's true, but a lot of that is because life is a breath. It's so temporary that can be gone just like that. That wasn't a very loud snap, was it? It is amazing how unpredictable it can be in that way. So I want to point out a couple of the ways that the same word is used in Psalm 39, for example. Give you an idea of the Hebel use of this same word here. In Psalm 39 at verse 5, it says, "You have made my days a few handbreadths, and my lifetime is as nothing in your sight. Surely everyone stands as a mere breath," and there's our word, Selah. What point is he trying to make about life there? Short. Short. And are you finding that your thought about how short life is getting more vivid? I'm finding that out. How brief. And that's our word. Psalm 39 again at verse 11. You chastise mortals in punishment for sin, consuming like a moth what is dear to them. Surely everyone is a mere breath. And having stood in rooms with people and seen the last one of those being taken, I recognize what that means. And that is behind what a lot of this writer's observations. So we're right here with Proverbs. So let me show you another example of the use of this word. Proverbs 31, about the worthy woman. Down at verse 30, charm is deceitful and beauty is vain. There's our word. But a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Now think about that. Is beauty useless, meaningless, worthless? Or is beauty temporary? Be careful. You see the point that he's making? Of course, beauty is valued and enjoyed and is seen as a blessing from God or a gift from God, but outward beauty, like the rest of our lives, is not permanent. It's fleeting because we don't last, so naturally it can't. So those two words will really be important as we go through. We're going to try to pursue what is he saying is vanity or meaningless or useless or brief, and why? And what does that then mean about what we do with the time we do have? So that brings us to some of the language of this book I want to just mention to you. And I think this first one is extremely important because it tells you the viewpoint that this writer or this speaker is thinking of from 1:2 to 12:8. Under the sun, 38 times in this book, that phrase is used. What does it tell you that he is making observations about what goes on under the sun? Daily life. But under the sun, from a viewpoint of life, the viewpoint of man, not from the viewpoint of God, but how things look to us from our viewpoint based on what we can see and what we can determine in the routines of everyday life, where we're observing and not where God is observing, under the sun. So this will be very important. Another pair of phrases that are important in this book are toil and profit. Toil is a word which it appeared here in chapter 1 in our kind of our theme verse, verse 3. What do people gain from all the toil at which they toil under the sun? Toil is work, effort, planning, energy, activity, all kinds of human pursuits. And profit is a word that appears 10 times in this book. It means what benefit comes from it, what do we gain from it, what are the pluses from it. Another phrase that would be important in this book is some form of the phrase grievous evil or grievous ill. It will be translated sore, S-O-R-E, evil or an ill like that, or something that is not fair, not right, not just, not how we want things to come out, etc. All of that type of thing. He'll say, I've seen a grievous ill or a grievous evil under the sun. But like chapter 6, verse 2, for example, give you an illustration of this. This is an evil that I've seen under the sun, verse 1, and it lies heavy on mankind. those to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor so that they lack nothing, have all that they desire, yet God does not enable them to enjoy these things, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is a grievous ill. Somebody invests all of his effort and activity and energy and thought into something, and then someone else enjoys it. Another word, very, very important, will be better. Often coupled with nothing, nothing better. There is nothing better, this writer will say. Chapter 2, verse 24 is a good example. There's nothing better for mortals than to eat and drink and find enjoyment in their toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. So notice that while he is thinking through all of this and recognizing that from a human point of view, there's all of this energy, toil, and money spent and effort put in, and yet a grievous ill can come along and wipe it out in a moment, and it not be fair or unjust, and it not matter whether you've been living righteously or wickedly. And yet in the middle of all that, he can say there's still some things that are better than others. And he'll recommend that. And then, really strikingly, when you think about it, given all the other things he will have observed, an important word is some form of the word enjoy. It may be joy or rejoice or enjoy, but 17 times in this book, he will call attention back to that. There are seven sections in this book which are known as the joy sections. And it's somewhat surprising to see somebody talking about how it's all a breath, it's all vanity, and yet really recommending taking joy in all the days of this vain life that you have. It doesn't sound like it fits, but that's what he will say. That tells you that he's not, this is not simply the work of a dark pessimist. It's somebody's telling us to accept God's gifts and enjoy them, but to remember that you, like all the rest of us, will die. There is one of the reasons why some writers will say this book is the biggest need of Western man. We are uncomfortable with death, with the reality of it. We would like to laugh it off and to shrug it off. Last year, I got a call one day from one of the, which funeral home place is it? It's downtown, off of, in the middle of town, down there, and it's a white, there you go, Lohmeyer. So they had somebody who needed help with a memorial, and they were from out of town, they didn't have anyone to do it, and for some reason they asked me to do that. I went down there, and the guy told me, I just had a family in here that wanted to do their memorial at 7:30 in the morning. And I came right after them. And they wanted it to be back here in this one corner, and they wanted to play loud music, and they didn't. The one thing was they wanted nothing sad and nothing religious. And that's how more and more it is. But as near as I can tell, death is a sad reality. And it's a very real thing. And we should be prepared to make sense of our lives in view of it and not to leave our families with the props knocked out of them by something that none of us ever prepared for. And that's kind of what this writer is trying to drive home. So just wrapping it up for a moment tonight, I would say the Ecclesiastes has a message that's more realistic than it is pessimistic. I think it is the work of somebody who has gotten alarmed and almost desperate by observing that his own life is with what he's been living for hasn't answered his need and won't matter. I think in this book there is it's an important balance to the other wisdom books. Proverbs tells how life works generally. Ecclesiastes talks about, well, what about the times when it doesn't work that way? How do you make sense of that? Job, of course, talks about what about the suffering that happens and that kind of thing. So wisdom is mentioned 54 times in this book. It's definitely a major theme. Wisdom is the right use of life, and that's what this is about. And this is the desperation of a fellow who has grappled with his own mortality and with its meaning to some degree from the viewpoint where God is not absent. This guy's not been an atheist. Several times between 1:2 and 12:8, 40 times he mentions God. But there's one interesting thing about this. The word for God in this book, all 40 times, is just the word God. It isn't the Lord, the covenant God. It isn't Jehovah or Yahweh. It's just God. And so this is somebody who lives in a world where he recognizes there must be a God, but he's not living in right relationship with God. God is not the center of his life. And he doesn't mention that until he gets to the end of the book where he talks about the whole duty of man. Our question tonight, what do people gain? If I removed from all the toil, and if I just said, what do people gain from Ecclesiastes then? I would say what's gained is a proper perspective about life and how to live it well. I'm interested in that. I think all of us are. And there might be some things in this book that not only help us, but help us help other people in Western secular culture to see that there has to be something more than secularism offers. Here's a little poem I ran across. There are lots of men who creep into the world to eat and sleep and know no reason why they're born save only to consume the corn, devour the cattle, bread and fish, and leave behind an empty dish. And if their tombstones when they die were not to flatter or to lie, there's nothing better can be said than that they've eaten up their bread, drunk their drink, and gone to bed. That's not a very good summary of life, is it? Would you be satisfied with that? No. And what this writer is going to tell us is, I've lived long enough and tried enough stuff to learn, you don't have to spend your life that way. And that's why when he gets in chapter 11 and 12, he can start talking about young people and he can say, remember before you get where I am. And I appreciate you all thinking along with me. Please read chapter 1, verse 16, all the way through chapter 2 for our class next week. And we'll just follow the text from here on and work our way through it and try to grapple with the message of this important book. Let's have a prayer before we go. Father, we do thank you for sparing our lives for all this time and for blessing us so well. And even though many things have happened that were never what we would have expected, even though sometimes things have shocked us, even though there have been and are things that seem to us to not make sense, We're so grateful for every reminder that you are the eternal God, that you do not change, that you stay involved in our lives, that you keep pursuing your purposes and your will, and that because of our having been made in your image, and because of our lives mattering to you, our lives have meaning and are important and are valuable, and that no matter what age we are, they stay valuable. Help us, Father, to have a respect for you, a reverence for you that gives us respect for ourselves. And help us, Father, to have our priorities in such a way that we can enjoy the best that life has to offer, and that we can remember what ought to be remembered, and that you can remember us. Please bless these dear people's lives. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Thanks, everybody.